Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
So this book is sort of the culmination of a lot of work that I've done over a lot of years. One of the chapters is actually still drawn from my dissertation and has sort of a parallel to an article that I wrote for Communication Quarterly. That's the chapter on graduate students. But it was also in a lot of ways, a very personal book because I've occupied a lot of the different ladders on the academic labor. I don't even like to call it a ladder anymore because it's barely goes up any hardly. But I was a graduate student, of course. I was an adjunct lecturer, sort of bopping around from lots of different colleges and universities trying to make a living for 7 years. And then I walked into this sort of netherworld of kind of full-time non-tenure track work before landing on the tenure track and then becoming a professor a few years ago. So something that I've also done a lot of work with academic labor unions. And I'm just wrapping up now a stint as the president of our local chapter of the AAUP here at Oakland. So those are all the things that sort of led me to writing this book.
Well, yeah. And so it's your interview. I want to talk more about the book. I will just add that you and I actually had very similar trajectories. I spent a lot of time as contingent faculty after I graduated. And in some ways, it was my own responsibility because I wasn't doing what I needed to do. But in other ways, it really is sort of a self-perpetuating cycle. And, you know, they warn you that once you get into that, it's really hard to get out. And I have seen, I get countless people just kind of wind up in that contingent labor position. And it does, right, it isn't a ladder. It's whatever the football players run through that have the ropes on it that's all vertical.
Yes.
all horizontal, right? It's just, you're just kind of moving left and right and left and right. And one of the things I've noticed is I got into my current tenure track position because I busted my ass for 2 years working way too many hours, setting zero boundaries, trying to be everything to everybody, hoping that it was going to result in me getting a job. And it did. And now when other adjunct faculty ask me like, oh, what did you do to get your line to turn into a tenure line? I don't even know what to tell them because I would never give someone the advice that I gave myself because there's no guarantee it'll work out, right? We still kind of have this myth that the hard work and the paying it forward into the university is going to reward you, but we see that happen over and over again that it doesn't. And I am the exception that proves the rule, right? Not an example of the rule.
Yeah, I feel exactly the same way. I as you said, I think that's a good way to put it. I feel as if my career is very much the exception. As a matter of fact, I mean, this is, you know, again, leaving my I'm right now the immediate past president of our faculty union, and the current president, and this is really unusual for academic labor unions, is herself a contingent faculty member. We're a mixed chapter that represents both contingents and full-time tenure track faculty, which is unusual enough as it is. But my friend, our current president, is herself a contingent. And it's just a testament to how great she is. But it's also a testament to the fact that here's someone who is extraordinarily well qualified, but who can't land a tenure track job.
Right.
And I don't think it's because of anything that she's done. It certainly has nothing to do with her talent. It has nothing to do with her skills or ability. Mm-hmm. It's just the fact that the academic labor system isn't producing tenure line jobs right now.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, well, and this is, you get to this point really early on in the book, and we could go in multiple directions here, because it's not only a really, I mean, incredibly practically applicable book, but you do some really nice theory here. And you even come up with this concept, the cognitariat, which is pretty clever. And I think that has a relationship to what you call sort of the professoriat, which is, you know, the noun for the professor class, and how the realities of that situation, especially for new and emerging faculty or people who have been on the market for maybe the last, like, I don't know, 10 years probably, doesn't line up with how people imagine that life is working. And that's a huge problem, obviously, for labor negotiations. So do you want to talk about maybe the professoriat or the cognitariat, or is there another case study you want to look at?
So the idea of the cognitariat isn't actually mine. I wish it were, but that actually came from the Italian autonomist. I'm seeing his nickname, but I'm not seeing his full name.
That's okay.
Biffo Berardi. And you know, he uses it to describe, and I think one of the hallmarks of it is, you know, a segment of the people who have to work for a living, who for a lot of reasons find more joy and satisfaction in their work than they do in almost any other part of their lives. Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, it's sort of a guiding question that led me through all of this work, is, you know, why is that, you know? And especially when I look around, you know, my colleagues in our department, but really even our colleagues across the university. And this is especially the case when we start to try to get them into labor activism. I'll use this as a story because I think it demonstrates the point. A few years ago, we were negotiating a contract. And of course, as part of that process, we were preparing to have a job action to go out on strike. And I was talking to a colleague, and she said, you know, she was relatively new, had not done this before. And she told me, I don't know that I could go out on strike because I don't know that I could do that to my students. And I thought it was really telling, because the sort of parallel would be if someone at General Motors refused to go out on strike because they couldn't imagine not making cars. And the fact of the matter is, you know, teaching students and doing some of the other things that we do is what we're compensated for. And in a lot of cases, we're not fairly compensated for it. And the best way to demonstrate that fact is to stop doing it in some way, shape, or form, either through, you know, some kind of a labor action. And we just have a really, like, I can't tell you how many discussions that I've had where faculty just have this block that they can't imagine themselves not doing the thing that they have to stop doing in order to be respected for it.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way of thinking about it, because you do hear people sort of push back with, well, the intellectual labor is so rewarding. And you're sort of saying, well, maybe. Or it's the thing, or it's your fantasy of intellectual labor that keeps you trapped doing labor. And people say this all the time, like, what are you doing in academia? You could be making a ton of money doing this someplace else. And some of it is obviously that I just enjoy the work I do more here and I find it more valuable. But some of it is you get trapped in this idea of the cognitariat. Yeah. And I didn't mean to imply that was your term. I just meant I thought it was a really great pick for kind of the crux of pulling all of these approaches together.
And I think it's an important term, because I think in a lot of ways, the faculty labor market, we've sort of led the way and demonstrated the possibilities for other industries as to how you can reconfigure a labor market around a kind of core of stable, full-time, relatively steady employment with a large circle of contingent, really precarious labor feeding it.
Yeah, and I see a lot of parallels between the way that we talk about academic labor to keep the fantasy alive. And I use the word, we should talk about denial in a bit, but fantasy is just kind of what I call constructing something that isn't real, right? The proof on the ground doesn't match up to what's in your head. So I know you don't use that word. It's just easy for me to use. But and entrepreneurs. In fact, I make a joke that like we're all becoming professorpreneurs.
Yes.
And both of them, I think, sort of thrive on this idea that this intellectual, rewarding, building things from the ground up kind of labor is going to somehow get us somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And really, I have to be honest with you, and maybe it's just a function of my age, but one of the things that I'm really poor at is that kind of and your term is great, if I can get it out, professorpreneurial labor in self-promotion. Right after I finished the book, one of my colleagues said, okay, now you have to go out on Twitter and start to promote it. And I just was like, oh, I don't want to do that. and you know, for just my own sort of hangups, but I recognize that increasingly that's just a necessity for people.
But it comes down to the same thing, which is this idea that people, that if you just tweet enough, it's somehow going to make a difference. But we've seen that just over and over again, not to be true. I read the other day that the average person who is successful on Twitter tweets 15 to 30 times per day.
Wow.
To get a couple of mentions. So you'd have to tweet about this book 15 to 30 times per day, and every tweet would have to have value. I mean, when you start to look at the facts, it really just doesn't line up with what we think of as this like awesomeness of self-promotion and building a brand and all that. That's part of the fantasy, right? And it's similar to academics, which is what you talk about in the chapter where you talk about how we imagine the professoriate in public discourse and then what that looks like in the academy.
Yeah.
Even the phrase the academy, I'm now realizing, is problematic.
in a lot of ways, yeah, it is. Because again, it sort of designates this really kind of separate space that that presumably looks a lot different than the rest of the world. But I'm not so sure that it is.
Oh yeah, I mean, I teach at a state school in upstate New York, and it's, you know, we live, I mean, we are very much the real world for many of those students. So I didn't realize that as much when I was teaching at a big R1 school down in the South, where everyone is like sort of a privileged college class, but I really get it now. So yeah, you want to talk more about maybe how denial functions in the situation, or what the professoriate is and how that gets constructed?
Sure. So, you know, the first two chapters, well, actually, not the first two chapters, because that's all sort of the theory building pieces of it. But the first sort of case studies have to do with the professoriate itself, about, you know, the people who teach, the people that we mostly think of as being professors, the full time tenure track, or, you know, the full professors like myself. And, you know, there's sort of two prongs to what I've identified as the concept of denial. One is just this sort of this notion of an overt denial. And I think we see this over and over again in a variety of different places. I highlighted a few places where that it seemed to be making the round sort of post-recession, where we see people saying, oh, the professoriate doesn't work, right? That what we do for a living when we walk into our classrooms, we don't do very much of that kind of teaching. And so we're essentially a pampered class of cosseted intellectuals who have an inflated sense of their own self-worth. And that message gets sent out in, as I said, a variety of different ways. The text that I was examining in particular were these sort of post-recession lamentations on the state of higher education, which, of course, you know, completely ignored the fact that the reason all of them grappled with the same problem, which I think it really is a problem, which is the rising price of tuition for almost every college student in the country. And you know, that is a detestable state of affairs for all of our undergraduates and our graduate students. Tuition should not be nearly as high as it is. But of course, all of them can't look to the actual cause of that rising price, which is the sort of retreat of the state from offering any kind of funding whatsoever for higher education. And instead, they think that we can place all of the blame on the fact that we have these tenured profs who get to take a semester off every 7 years and don't actually come to classes. They have their summers off, which is also, you know, one of the biggest jokes that I think exists in higher education is the idea of the summer off. Mm-hmm. I always tell people that summer is sort of when you get back to real work again, having enjoyed the company of
your students. Good luck taking 7 summers off and then getting tenure.
Yeah, exactly.
See how that works out for you.
or even after that fact, good luck taking your summers off and earning a promotion to full professor and then even after that fact, with a lot of different schools starting to institute various versions of post-tenure review, mm-hmm. That doesn't exist. Summers are the period of time where you sort of, buckle down and actually do a lot of the work that is the thing that's going to earn you whatever kind of salary increases there are available to you.
Well, and I think this is a good point for the listeners because, I think one of the things that often gets misunderstood is that just because you can think of a couple examples of, I can right now think of a couple of examples of people who got tenure and are now resting on their laurels and doing exactly the kinds of things you're saying. But just because we can think of those few examples doesn't mean that collectively that is the what is happening, right? So the examples sort of prove the rule. And this is why this book is really important because it really does a lot of legwork to lay the land in a way that really shows its misalignment with, I think, the public perception of what is happening.
Yeah, I think there's when I talk to people outside of the university and they think about what it is like. I mean, this is kind of a weird story, but I was talking to my cousin's wife at a funeral.
We love weird stories on the New Books Network.
I'm talking to my cousin's wife at a funeral, and we were having this discussion, and my spouse had given me a something to hang in my office, and my cousin looks at his wife and says, "Hey, that's a good idea. Why don't you ever give me something to put in my office?" And she looked at me and said, "Well, because he's a professor, he has a nice office." And I was sort of imagining in my head what she was thinking of when she thought of sort of the professorial office, And I was thinking of the television show Friends, right? When Ross was a professor at the university, and there's this great big wooden desk, and every faculty, every professor's office that appears on television looks like it just stepped out of the set of the Gilmore Girls or something, and that just is nothing like the reality of what most of us at state schools are working in. I mean, my desk is something from, as a matter of fact, thinking about the Gilmore Girls, my desk is a surplus from the Korean War that I saw in an episode of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel back to the 1950s. So, that's about how frequently they update, the spaces that we work in.
Yes, I work in the first women's dorm on campus, so I have an enormous office that is surrounded with asbestos, and we can't drink out of the water. So right, and I think there's a lot of paradoxes here, and that's one thing the book is really good at pointing out is that these myths survive because there are remnants of them circulating. So that's not to say that I don't have a huge office, but it's also to say that a lot of the baggage that comes with this idea of the professor office is maybe not in alignment with how most people are experiencing life these days.
Right. And even then, the focus here is on those, 30% of us or so who are fortunate enough to be on the tenure track, who are fortunate enough to sort of be on the ladder, and leaving aside the new faculty majority, the 70% or so who are teaching the bulk of the classes, our contingent faculty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I work with several faculty members who are contingent who routinely lose their voices and get bronchitis and other kinds of ailments because they are lecturing hundreds of students multiple times a day, especially at the beginning of the semester when they're doing all of the legwork to, say, teach the safety measures for the biochem classes. Yeah. And, you know, their health is at risk and they don't get paid very well. And actually, and so to bring this back to the book, you make a comment that academic labor, so this is on page 63, the difference between academic labor and other forms of labor renders the former strange beyond recognition.
Yeah. So this is sort of, so again, the first case study is about how people have framed academic labor and essentially sort of denying that that we do enough teaching for it to constitute a real job, that the service that we perform really just sort of gets in the way of actually of the university functioning. People have some especially nasty things to say about academic labor unions there.
I'm part of our labor union and it's pretty vicious.
Yeah. And of course that the research that we write isn't worth the paper that it's written on. But then there's this other form of denial, I think, that we as academics are susceptible to that I've called a kind of repressed denial, where we ourselves conceptualize our labor as this very, one, we think of it as being different, right? And I think I found a chapter by Edward Said, where he talks about being pulled aside early on in his career by someone who tells him that academic labor is, you know, very strange because, and that ultimately it's all much better than working, right? Like, and that what we do isn't actually work because we get to go into the classroom and we get to talk about Plato and Aristotle or, you know, whatever it is that we're, or, you know, the Gilmore Girls, I guess. And that, you know, there's this sort of ratcheting up that happens in this denial where the basic framework is that may all be true, but it comes at the cost of us having to effectively erase the boundary that exists between work and non-work. Mm-hmm. I thought an article that Stanley Aronowitz wrote on this topic was especially telling, where he writes his work. He writes a work diary where he kind of describes in really exacting detail all of the stuff that goes into a working day, and you know, looking at it from the outside, it was sort of just exhausting to read, let alone think about what it would be like to live through all of that. And then he just sort of makes the claim that, but it's okay because I really enjoy doing all of this, so it doesn't really feel like labor to me. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the case for a lot of us. I was telling a friend that, you know, since we're all in quarantine, and I said one of my first projects was to power through Thomas Piketty's Capital and Ideology. And so in a few weeks, I read this 1,000-page book on the history of income inequality. And my son kept asking me, he's like, is that for work or is that because you enjoy it? And I said, well, yes, both, neither.
Yeah. My partner's always saying, I can never tell if you're working or just on that computer. And I was like, it's all the same. There's nowhere, but that's also a myth I tell myself because sometimes it's not. So it all gets kind of tangled up. In ways that are, which is kind of your point. It's not whether it's bad or good. It's just, it's happening and it has consequences, right? And some of those consequences are fine because some people don't care about, you know, getting stooped over while they sit at their computer for hours a day toiling away. And some people find it extremely emotionally draining and some people aren't given health benefits and some people aren't properly compensated. And so it's really, like I said, just a lay of the land. It's not a bitch fest about academic labor. It's very much just kind of a fair assessment about the ways it's getting constructed and the consequences that might have.
Yeah. And I think, you know, again, one of the consequences, and this is probably something I should have elaborated on in the conclusion more than I did, but I think we really sort of set a bad example for our students in a lot of ways. That is when...
Totally agree. Oh, yes, absolutely. You should write a separate paper on this. I would read it for sure.
Yeah, I think you know, we are so heavily invested in this idea that you have to do what you love, even if it means not necessarily getting fairly compensated for it, that we send that value off to the people that we, you know, and I think in a weird way, I think the students, they read it. They may not understand the details, mm-hmm. but I think they get it. I mean, they know that our contingent counterparts are not being paid a fair wage, and yet they continue to walk into the classroom every day and do mm-hmm. what amounts to a phenomenal job being there.
Yeah.
And I think it devalues all of our work.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They do get it. And I know that because I'm the advisor to our student newspaper.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They write a lot about faculty labor negotiations and issues with contingent faculty and course overload and workload creep. I mean, they really are tuned into these things.
Yeah. And then, but even beyond that, I think it's sort of the value of, you know, put your work first above yeah. almost anything else that comes in your life yeah. That they carry with them when they go into the workplace. You know, I haven't written the specific paper, but I do have an article in Western mm-hmm. that talks about, you know, the trend. Well, it's about how we've come to accept unpaid internships.
Oh, I know. They are so exploitative. I hate them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in New York, they actually passed a law, but it still allows college credit to seep through the crack. So as long as you're getting college credit, you can still have an unpaid internship.
Right. Like that makes a difference.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah. All right. Well, speaking of students, I mean, one of the things I thought, I don't know if this was something that happened naturally or if you just kind of knew that this was a good move, but you have several chapters where you talk about students as not only being cognizant of what's happening, but also being actively part of the labor force that's kind of, you know, participating in this cluster of contradictions. And you talk about graduate student unions, and you also talk about student athletes, which was really fascinating. So I don't know if you want to maybe talk about a little bit more, because we haven't talked, for example, about chapter three does a great job of looking at critics of the professoriate and the way that they sort of circulate these problematic idealizations of our lives in pop culture, so that people kind of, yeah, exactly, get this like bad taste in their mouth about what teachers do. And I think that's important too, because it also seeps over into K-12, because you hear people talking about K-12 teachers and their summers off. And it's like, I wouldn't trade lives with a K-12 teacher for all the money they don't get paid.
Oh yeah. No, there's,
so it all gets clustered together in really problematic ways.
And I think, well, I would hope, and I maybe I have too much optimism, but I would hope to God that one of the effects of all of this quarantine business is that some of these parents who are with their kids see some portion of the work that it takes to actually teach K-12 and maybe rethink some of those assumptions.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Yeah, I mean, one would hope, because K-12, I mean, even more in some ways, I think, than at least tenure track faculty, K-12 faculty are undervalued for sure.
Oh, there's no question.
Yeah, but graduate, I thought graduate students were a really good example too, because graduate students are a huge exploited labor market that often flies under the radar, because it seems like going to graduate school is already kind of such a bourgeois luxury, who cares about how they're treated sort of thing.
Yeah, it is. And a lot of people have that idea. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, graduate students across the country at any number of institutions have been resisting that idea.
You know I'm being sarcastic, right?
What's that? Oh yeah, of course.
Okay, because yeah. I said it, and then I thought, like, oh, no, I hope he doesn't think that's what I think. I just meant I think that's the perception. Right?
Oh, absolutely not. No, I got it. No, I think anyone who has been through the graduate student mill, I'm not sure that you could come to that conclusion. No, graduate students across the country are probably in a lot of ways at the forefront of trying to reimagine what the university might look like in the future. The biggest problem that they face, obviously, is that they're only at their institutions for a finite period of time, which makes them really an interesting segment of the workforce to try to organize, right? Because they don't have, by definition, the kind of institutional memory that it takes to fight against some of the worst elements of administrative control that there are. About a year ago, I got off the phone with someone who was contacting our union for advice on contracts, and they had undergone a 20-year campaign to win recognition for their faculty union. And you think about that.
20 years. Wow.
Yeah. It was, I can't remember the name of the institution. It was in Pennsylvania. But if you think about it, that's possible because, you know, a professor can be in a job for 20 years. If you're talking about graduate students, you know, if the system is doing its job even remotely well, they're moving on in 7 years. And that means that they've got to train the newest people to come in and sort of pick up the fight and continue it. And so the leadership is sort of constantly morphing and evolving. But these are the folks, you know, I think we use them up for cheap labor for a period of time and then send them off into a work world where there's literally almost no jobs of any consequence for them to take. You know, they're coming out and they're getting at best contingent work. The chapter is mostly about the 95 Yale grade strike, where graduate assistants at Yale University trying to win recognition for their fledgling union withheld their grades at the end of the semester simply to prove that they were actually doing work, that they were actually performing labor for the institution. And there are a variety, you know, and this is unfortunately one of those things that changes with administrations. But whenever we get a Republican-dominated National Labor Relations Board, the definition of graduate student labor shifts to the idea that, well, since they're students, they can't be workers. And then we get Democrats in charge of the NLRB and it shifts, and we get the idea that, well, they can be workers even though they are students.
Mm-hmm, right.
And I think at some point we just need to come clean and say, look, like at our institution, we're a relatively small school, not small, we're 20,000 or so. But
oh, you're huge compared to my institution.
Okay. So, but we're not, you know, but we're not an R1, right?
No, definitely not. Yeah.
But what has it, so we don't have a lot of graduate students on campus, but one of the things that we just started a small master's program in our department. And one of the things that we keep seeing are students who are hired in to do work in some department, often athletics or someplace else, and then told to go find a degree program. So the job comes first, and then they think about what degree they might want to earn.
Yeah, that's interesting because I, speaking of Twitter, I got in a little bit of a Twitter tiff the other day because someone posted, it's don't go into debt to go to grad school. And they were commenting on if you get accepted to a grad school, but you don't get funding. And I was like, well, kind of. But I mean, it depends how much debt. It depends on how much you're going to get out of grad school. It depends on your other options. I mean, there are other reasons not to apply to a competitively funded program, like the fact that there's a toxic culture of competition. Yeah. Like this idea that just like, no, all debt is bad, not worth grad school. I was like, what if it's 10 grand for 4 years of a PhD? What? I mean, that might be something. I mean, it was just this blatant, no, it's bad now. And I was like, well, let's not just take the exact opposite stance. Let's give people realistic expectations and help guide them through decision-making. But it's like people have gotten so caught up now in this idea that going to grad school is exploitative that now you see the opposite thing happening, which is just all grad school is bad, get a job first and then go to grad school. It's like, well, those are both just choices, right? And we need to help people navigate choices, not just turn everything into an all or nothing.
And in a lot of ways, and this is just my personal experience, but I did my PhD unfunded. I didn't have to take out any debt, but I, because this was back a few years, but I just paid for it out of my pocket. Mostly it was because I was sort of trapped in I had a health insurance plan through because of our labor union. And I couldn't move on to a graduate student health insurance plan because they excluded my type 1 diabetes. And I could not have paid for those expenses out of pocket. But the other reason that I'm still thankful for it is because, as you said, the toxic competitiveness of graduate programs, especially in those fully funded things, enough said, they're toxic.
Yeah, and this is what I think is important about your book, is that there is no one-size-fits-all solution. So even if you read this whole book, you're not going to come away thinking graduate school sucks. Like, there are just problems, and there are discourses about those problems that get circulated as if they are the truth. And we need to really be pushing back because there are many reasons, good reasons to go to graduate school. But there are also huge problems with the way that graduate students are treated, especially in non-unionized environments, which unfortunately now is most places. And, you know, America is really hostile to unions right now. And it's been really awful for graduate students trying to unionize. We tried to unionize when I was at Georgia in the early 2010s, and it was not happening.
I once, when I was working on my dissertation, I was writing about graduate student unions. I got on the plane to NCA. And it was with someone who was coming from Georgia. So he was on a connecting flight, and I told him, and he just laughed at me.
Yeah.
like the very idea of him joining a union was just completely laughable in his mind.
Yeah.
I think that's true for a lot of people. For the most part, I still maintain that unions can make our lives better.
Yes, I am part of a union, and my father threatened to disown me for joining a union because he said we were all thugs. And I was like, we sit in meetings and talk about health benefits.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it comes down to.
Yeah.
I think probably the place where I'm most ambivalent is in the chapter, and ambivalent is the wrong word, but the place where I find it most problematic is in the chapter on student athletes.
Yeah, actually, and let's move there because we haven't talked about student athletes. And I'd really like to come back to your chapter on contingent faculty because I think we touched on it, but I think there's more to be said. So yeah, tell us about the chapter on student athletes and your takeaways from that.
So the chapter on contingent athletes begins with a case study with Northwestern University athletes who tried to form a labor union. Northwestern is Northwestern, not the greatest football school in the world, but, has a great academic reputation. But these students there voted to join voted to join the United Steelworkers. And that's another place where I think students, graduate students and these folks at Northwestern, I think it's absolutely fantastic that some of these Some of these people who aren't the professoriate are choosing to affiliate themselves with traditional blue-collar labor unions. So graduates, the largest representative of graduate students in the country is the United Auto Workers, because they organized all of the University of California system, plus a number of others, schools. I think they are involved in the NYU efforts as well. And then you've got the student athletes who are trying to join the Steelworkers Union.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, if there's, this is one of the conversations that I had, but my grandfather was the president of his UAW local. And he started to read my dissertation, and he looked up at me at one point, and he was in his 80s at this point, and he said, "Who at Solidarity House, which is the headquarters for the UAW, talks like this?"
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I think, in some ways I've been sort of mulling around that question for a long time, and trying to, I would like to do some sort of almost like an ethnographic work, mm-hmm, on what that relationship looks like between auto workers and steel workers, or the Service Employees International Union, and the traditional academic labor unions, because we have trouble in our union of even affiliating with. So in higher education, there are three main unions, right? There's the NEA, National Education Association, the American Federation of Teachers, and the AAUP.
Mm-hmm.
And only the AFT is affiliated with the AFL-CIO.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of people, like, there are all kinds of benefits to being affiliated with the AFL-CIO. You saw this in the graduate student case, where graduate students were attempting to organize through the UAW, at one point the University of California system took a hardline stance on them. The UAW dropped a check into their account, and the California system started to talk. So, you know, there's all kinds of benefits to those kinds of resources, but for reasons of, and again, I think it's this notion of denial that somehow we're different or other than other kinds of labor, that we just won't affiliate with steel workers or auto workers or service employees or any, you know, communications workers, et cetera.
Well, and I think that that's a cornerstone of how anti-union efforts work, right? You need, like, unions depend on coalition building, and
yeah.
I'm not saying there's some giant conspiracy. I'm just saying the way that everything has come together, the hostility, and it's similar to other coalition building. I mean, you saw when, like, Occupy Wall Street tried to create affiliations among immigrants, student workers, steel workers, the audio industry, and it kind of worked a little bit, but those animosities among those groups, again, exactly like you talk about in the book, because there's this sense that some labor is real and other labor is false, and the real labor is always your labor and the false labor is always the other person's labor, makes it really hard to build coalitions among those people. And that's very good for anti-union sentiment.
Yeah. Although I don't know if it's so much that, you know, some, like, for instance, we had, we're talking about membership in our union, and there was a member of the nursing faculty who said, am I in the union because I don't want to be, because I don't want to have any part of unions.
Hmm.
And not because I don't think it was because she didn't respect what she did. It was that's something that blue collar workers do. That's something that,
Interesting.
Different. Hmm. And it doesn't afford with my status as a professional, which is why I think our young, you know, the student athletes and the graduate students are so fascinating, because they just apparently don't seem to care very much. The UAW will represent their interests. They join the UAW. The steel workers will help them out.
Right.
They'll join the steel workers. And I think that's a healthier perspective than to say, oh, I'm a college professor, therefore I can't be in this kind of institution. I mean, really, this is another one of those personal moments that brought me to this project was, you know, the first time I was on strike, and I'm standing out in front of the university and I'm holding my picket sign and I'm with a bunch of other faculty. I was a contingent at the time, so I was sort of scared for my life because I didn't know what this was going to mean for me. And a truck driver pulled up and went on the road next to the university, walked up to us and said, "Hey, I don't want to cross your picket line, but I've got these deliveries that I'm supposed to make. Huh. What do you want me to do?"
Sure.
And you know, the right answer is drive away and don't make your deliveries, right? Honor our picket because we're all laboring together. But all of my faculty cohort were just like, go on in. It'll be fine. And it's like, you know, I don't know that this is the way it's supposed to work. Yeah,
right.
You know,
that's,
I mean,
so interesting. Yeah.
You know, but again, I think it's because, you know, they didn't want to think of themselves as being in the same category as Teamsters.
Well, yeah, and it's a discourse. And I think this is what's really important about your book is that these things are not just set in stone, but they're how we've been taught to think and talk about our relationship to Teamsters, and that relationship could change.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
And you did some really good stuff with the student athletes talking about this concept of amateurism.
Yeah.
And it made me think of what you said about the nurse and how, like, they're a professional, and so, and how these classifications create these they're not artificial, they're very real, but these perceived real boundaries that also sort of could be places where we could create more coalitions.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, the chapter on student athletes was in a lot of ways the hardest one, but because there is so much complexity that goes into what happens with student athletes. I mean, the first thing is, I think, you know, we all have to acknowledge that, especially in the revenue producing sports, mostly men's basketball and men's football, those students are in no way, shape, or form student athletes. I mean, they are brought to campus
for
almost the sole reason of producing, using their bodies in order to entertain us all and turn a profit for the institution.
Yes, I have some real horror stories of teaching football players at a D1 school in the South, if they're not labor, I mean, if they're not labor, I'm definitely not labor. Do you know what I mean? So, which is to say, they're labor. I mean, through and through.
And that's even, you know, we're a D1 school. We don't have a football team, but we have a basketball team. But this is where the complexities come in. I mean, Georgia is one of the Power Five conferences. So those folks at least have, I mean, it's slim, but you can at least sort of squint and imagine that one day that they can use their skill on the field to make a living at something. We're at a Division I school that's sort of in one of the non-Power Five conferences, and our basketball players put in ungodly number of hours, and there's no way that any of them are ever going to turn a living playing basketball. It's just not possible. That their only hope is to get the degree, but they're putting in so many hours at what they do that getting that degree is a challenge. It's a real uphill climb for a lot of them, solely because of, I think, the time and investment that it takes. And of course, the fact that they live and die by what the coach tells them to do. They almost have no way of resisting management orders, right? Because they don't have any organized voice to be able to say, these are the limits that I can practice and still be able to go to school and earn my education. And so even if there isn't necessarily a union, the biggest thing that has to happen, I think, for student athletes is that they need to have some kind of collective voice in decision-making. Whatever that ends up looking like, they need to have some way of saying what is possible for their work lives while they are in school.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you Do you see any possibilities to connect student labor with contingent faculty?
In what sense?
Well, like, do you see their struggles as somehow aligning? Because I've noticed that, at least on our campus, the student athletes and other types of exploited student workers, like the work study students who get paid sub-minimum wage, for example, right? Because it's work study. They have deep sympathies for what the contingent faculty are going through in a way that I think that some students who are not students who work, they are students who do not work, right? Do not, like, not that they don't have sympathy, but they just aren't in the same boat. And so it seems to me like that's where interests are already aligned. But I can't imagine a way, I mean, just thinking off the top of my head about how they could work together, but it does seem like there's a lot of potential there.
I think that's probably one of the hardest questions is there a way to align the interests of, because, you know, align the interests of a lot of these different labor groups. Because, I mean,
I don't mean to put you on the spot. That's always what everybody wants to ask, right? Okay, well, you've written this book. Now, what do I do about it? The book is valuable in the sense of giving you a new perspective on the lay of the land. And that's what I loved about the book. I mean, this is only one of many steps to strategizing, but it's a great early step is to understand from your perspective what's happening.
Yeah, but I do think that's an important question. And it would be, you know, because there have been increasing efforts. I was just reading about it someplace where undergraduate students who do things like residence halls assistants, right, are starting to organize themselves because, you know, again, you're talking about a class of employee that puts in just absolutely ungodly number of hours at the work that they do. And they're supposed to be grateful because, you know, they get a room in the dorm and a small stipend. And increasingly they're finding, no, I'm making sub-minimum wage based on the number of hours I'm putting in at this. And they're organizing to try to, level the playing field a little bit. And so, in an ideal world or in a better world that we should do something to try to unite all of these factions of people who work for the university. But again, you know, we have trouble even in our union keeping the alliance between contingents and our tenure track faculty together.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I don't know that there's any easy answers to those things.
But one thing this book is great for is we've purchased a copy for our faculty, for our UUP office, and also one for the library. And I've already sent emails to several people letting them know they really should pick up this book because it gives a lot of language to problems that is really helpful. I think that's one of the biggest value of critical rhetoric is that it gives you like discourses of denial, like professoria. Like these are terms that are very approachable in the book, and I think anybody can understand them. And also this idea that labor is that there aren't really different kinds of labor in a real sense, or labor is labor in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I mean, at some point, you know, everybody has to go to work to put food on the table and a roof over their heads. And when you do something like that, and even for us, you know, the tenure track faculty, you know, obviously, one of the upsides is that I can sit down and I can write a book that is critical of my employers.
Sure.
And that's, you know, and I don't want to downplay any of the freedom that entails.
Right.
But at the same time, I have to write a book about something in order to continue my employment in any sort of reasonable way, in order to continue to earn raises, and in order to continue to be a member of my academic community. And whenever we are under the direction, even in that loose sense, of someone else, I think we're working for a living. And when people work for a living, I think they are better served by having a collective sense of what that means.
Well, and I think the collective is important here because certainly any one of us can look at this. And you're really like, this is a book about a system. This is not a book about the professoriate. It's not a book about student athletes. It's not a book about labor unions. I mean, it really looks at a system of labor just in a specific industry, right? If we want to use that term.
Yeah.
And it's easy to say like, oh, well, I'm different than a student athlete. But at the end of the day, if if we need to make change, you're going to have to find ways to build connection. And this book is a great way of finding ways to both validate your feelings of difference, but also recognize your opportunities for connection to other people's labor struggles.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah. Again, even though, you know, even though we are different, we're all sort of working for the same folks.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, at this point in history, like, we're all working for basically the same people.
Yeah. I mean, and really, you know, and especially, you know, especially these days, you know, academic institutions are being led by people who are not academics.
I know.
And yes. And so, you know, the fact that they're coming from industry, the fact, you know, like, we just had someone leave our university. This is a bizarre story also, but we had a guy who was on the board of trustees. He was an executive at Chrysler Motors. And one minute he's on the board of trustees, and then the next day he resigns from the board of trustees, and the day after that he was hired to be the chief operating officer of the university. And on one level, it's like the ultimate form of sort of crony capitalism. On another level, it's this idea that universities need business people to lead them because academics are so weird that we can't do it ourselves.
Which I would argue is another one of these myths, because it's like, well, everyone really needs organization. I just don't necessarily think it needs to be top-down autocratic organization. But to say that like one group is more capable of leading themselves than another is...
No, it's absurd.
Yeah, it's unhelpful. I mean, even if you believe it's true, I mean, I tell my students this all the time, like, there's what you know is true from personal experience, and then there's what is helpful for you to think. And even if I think my labor is different than a Teamster's, at this point in history with like the threat that like fair work wages are under, do we really want to keep that thought? Is it helpful, right?
I don't.
I don't. I don't believe it. But number two, even if I did, it's not getting anywhere but more divide and conquer.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, and this is this conversation is so good. We have barely even skimmed the surface of this book, which I have already recommended to 10 people, and I probably will recommend it to everyone I meet who is interested in any of these issues. Do you want to touch on anything else before we wrap?
No, I know I've listened to some of your other interviews. I know one of the questions that you sometimes ask at the end is to pitch another book.
Oh, and yeah. So, if you want to get there, that's my sign off question. So if you feel like we've covered everything about the book that you really want to highlight, I'd love to hear about a recommendation you might have for a new book for the next interview.
Sure. I'm going to recommend a couple of my colleagues have just finished a book, and this is another great one of those. It's another great example of the kind of coalition building that that I think we're talking about here, and that I think is necessary, not just in labor, but really it's sort of across our culture. Mm-hmm. But my colleagues, Rebecca Ferrugia and Kelly Hay, have just released their book, Women Rapping Revolution.
Ooh, rapping like Christmas rapping or rapping like hip hop rapping?
Hip hop rapping.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, so it's the culmination of, I think it was a 7-year ethnographic project that my colleagues undertook in the city of Detroit, working with a women's collective that was producing women's oriented rap. And I'm not going to pretend to know very much more about it other than, it's really about that kind of building relationships and working in coalitions and the tensions that are involved in it, but also the kind of revolutionary possibilities that can come out of trying to look past differences and as you put it, I think very well, seeing what kinds of thoughts actually work for us in working together to resist some of the insanity that's going on in the world.
Yeah, and they have, I just looked it up while you were talking, they actually have the foreword written by Mahogany Jones, who is who's like a really like uplifting sort of like women's empowerment hip hop artists. So that's amazing. I'm going to reach out to them right now. Well, Tom, this has been an awesome conversation. I just want to leave everyone with one of my favorite sentences that comes out of actually just the book description on the website. And that is this: the professoriate is therefore not a retrograde figure of a more genteel time, but the emblematic figure of late capitalism's transition to cognitive labor, and with it, an unceasing colonization of the human life world. So, stellar sentence. I think it wraps up the conversation well, and I cannot recommend enough that everyone pick up a copy of Discourses of Denial from Routledge from 2017 by Tom DeSena. Also, just a reminder, we work very closely, the New Books Network, with presses like Routledge and other university presses, because they really put in a kind of underpaid effort to try to get our work out, as do we put in a lot of money to get these books published. It's not like a traditional. So anyone thinking that we get $50,000 book advances like they do on TV, most of our books, we actually lose money on to pay for the copyright. But we do appreciate what the presses do, because they help at least increase the quality of the ideas. And even if you don't want a copy for yourself, you can request one for your public library or your university library. You can also buy a hard copy. They like hard copies. So, paperback will work. And you can donate it. And then that way, these ideas are on the shelf for people that would love to have access to them. And you're also helping reward everyone for academic labor and other kinds of labor as well. So once again, you can pick that up. I see that we actually have it listed on the New Books Network. So if you Google Discourses of Denial, New Books, it's up there and you can purchase right from the website. Otherwise, Tom, is there anywhere that people can reach out to you if they want to chat or have any thoughts on your book?
Oh, absolutely. You can reach me at my email address. It's my last name, DeSena, DISCENNA, at oakland.edu.
Wonderful. And I'll put that in the show notes for anyone that's listening on their commute, if and when we ever commute again, and that you that you would like to click there and let Tom know what you thought or ask more about how you can find the book. So Tom, once again, great to listen to everything you had to say today. Listeners, thank you for tuning in, and we will see you or hear you next time on the New Books Network.